Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, just as we spent our, not all that bad, but it was our bad martini yesterday, talking about don't get too excited about all these polls coming out. Our good martini today is look at the great polls that are coming out. Officially, the Real Clear Politics average, I believe for the first time, at least for the first time in a very long time, has Mitt Romney up ahead of President Obama, when just several days ago this was a pretty significant lead for the president. I have noted to you off air, Jim, that I am not a huge fan of the Real Clear Politics average because it equates old polls with new polls. It equates one polling firm with another, and some are obviously more reputable than others. But in the end, they're all trending in the right direction here. And as a result of that, following last week's dominant debate performance, Mitt Romney's got the lead. That's good news.
Indisputably, for all the flaws of polling, and one of the things that I noticed yesterday that was spotlighted by some of the guys in Newsbusters, something to keep in the back of your mind as you read all these polls, some fairly significant chunk of people who tell pollsters that they're likely to vote are lying. There's no other way to put it. And one of the ways they know that is that they said, you know, 40% of the people who told the Pew pollsters that they always vote, there is no record of that person at that address voting in 2010. So when you say always vote, perhaps some of these people mean, well, sometimes. And if they're not accurate on that, there's a possibility they're not accurate on that. But to the extent the polls measure things, we see the numbers going the right direction for Mitt Romney. Whether it's Rasmussen, whether it's Survey USA, whether it's Gallup, whether it's Pew, CNN, all of them are moving in the right direction for Romney, some by a little, most of them by quite significant numbers. And the state polls are moving, too. Survey USA out this morning has Obama only up one in Ohio, which for much of this year been a very tough state for Romney. Nevada, Obama up by one. This was a state where I thought, you know, it was starting to drift pretty heavily blue. Democrats still have a fairly significant voter registration edge in that state, but looking pretty good for them. If you're within one, you definitely are within striking distance on Election Day. So basically, since this debate, it's just been this big event. And you kind of wonder if there's some sort of cascade effect going on, the idea being that as Romney becomes a more serious and plausible candidate, he's not the guy who seems hapless and who's flailing and the guy who suddenly comes ahead, you get this bandwagon effect. People who were looking for an excuse to come off the Obama bandwagon now have it. It's kind of strange that people want to always go with a winner and, you know, the people might be so fickle. But the bottom line is Romney's got a lot of momentum here. And you kind of wonder if, like, I think it was, you know, Sean Trend who'd put it yesterday, look, The fundamentals of this political environment were always very tough for President Obama. And one of the ways he kept those fundamentals at bay was creating the sense of inevitability, that Obama was way ahead, that Romney was hapless, that the Republican Party was divided, Democrats were unified, and they were winning the ad war. And that worked for a while until the debates, and then it suddenly didn't work. And it's like a balloon has popped, and it's now a very different political environment, and one that is, it's probably not crazy to say that Romney is now the favorite.
What a difference a debate makes. Apparently, a very small percentage of people think Obama won, and apparently he's in that percentage. That was the big story yesterday. I think out of the
New York actually polled him. It was very strange. They called 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Asked for the is the head of household there? She's not. Okay, can we speak to anyone else there? Okay, yes. How do you spell your name, sir? O-B-A-M-A. Gotcha. Okay, and how do you think the president did in the debate? Really good. Really. Really? Anyway, okay. Yeah. Who's the comedian who does one side of the phone conversation?
Bob Newhart? Is that
Bob Newhart. That's my Newhart for the day.
Excellent. Well, on to the bad martini, and unfortunately a far more serious topic. The House Government Reform and Oversight Committee today will be hearing testimony on what went tragically wrong at the U.S. consulate in Benghazi on 9/11. The figure that will be the focus of attention today is Eric Nordstrom, who is in charge of security at the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli and obviously oversaw security at Benghazi as well. Jake Tapper, White House correspondent for ABC News, has reported on this and has gotten a glimpse of what the testimony is likely to include today. And here's part of what he included in his report this morning on Good Morning America.
ABC News has learned that although Eric Nordstrom and the commander of an American security team also in Libya had heard that foreign fighters were flowing across the Egyptian border, State Department officials seemed oblivious to the Benghazi consulate's vulnerability. Nordstrom told investigators he was worried A local Libyan security brigade in Benghazi consisted mostly of merchants and shopkeepers and had received no pay in months, other than a daily $30 stipend for food from the embassy. I had no idea if they would respond to an attack, Nordstrom told investigators.
And we'll hear more today. We're also hearing, Jim, that the last couple of requests didn't even get a response from the State Department. Now the administration is finally moving away from this idea that there was this Cairo copycat effect that somehow morphed into a deadly assault, when in fact it was just a deadly assault. So a lot of answers upcoming here. Finally, somebody's actually interested in the truth.
Yeah, and this is one of the most consequential issues we're going to see discussed between now and Election Day. This is, you know, besides literally a life and death issue, one of the things that kind of is kind of fascinating as the coverage of this story continues, and we have to give a little bit of credit to the mainstream media for not dropping this issue and for actually paying attention, is that there's two separate very big questions looking at this attack and what preceded it and what came after it. The question of preceding it is, why was this place so lightly guarded? Why were it sounds like so many warnings were coming from the ground? And it just sounds like some folks in Foggy Bottom were oblivious to it or ignoring it or downplaying it. What was the calculus involved in that decision? And why did so many people seem to overrule or ignore or dismiss the concerns coming from people on the ground? The second question is what came after the attack, which was, why did the administration insist that this was tied to that YouTube video for a good, you know, 7 or 8 days, including a really infamous series of appearances by U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice? She did all the Sunday shows, and her spin was that this was mostly related to the YouTube video. There was no way to predict terror attacks against U.S. targets on September 11th, an assertion most people found pretty implausible right when she said it. But now we're saying, look, the intelligence community is saying, look, within 24 hours, we had indications this was from Al-Qaeda. The State Department is throwing their bosses under the bus and saying, wait a minute, we never said this was related to the YouTube video. So now we're really left the question, where did Susan Rice get this information? Where did she come to that conclusion? Where did Hillary? Where did President Obama? Why was President Obama still saying it was tied to a YouTube video when he did the Univision interview quite a few days later? It's a baffling and frustrating, and look, it's very easy to come to the very worst suspicions, which is that the administration didn't like what the truth was. That, you know, Al-Qaeda was still a major presence in the Middle East and still capable of killing Americans in sites that thought were secure. They wanted to cover up how bad the decisions were regarding security, and they wanted to protect their jobs right before an election. So they lied. And we will see the hearing starts at 12 noon today. I'm expecting some fireworks. For people who are cynical about the way government works, stories like this are really even beyond our most cynical conclusions, because it basically says that people in Foggy Bottom don't care about the people over in the embassies and consulates. They ignore the threats. They dismiss the threats. And then when they do, they're interested in covering their butts and not holding anyone accountable. It's ugly. Ordinarily, Greg, I'd be calling for Susan Rice to be dismissed. But, you know, the good news is that there's an excellent chance that becomes a moot point in just about 4 weeks from now.
Let's certainly hope so. I know this will be a big topic, at least it should be a big topic at the foreign policy presidential debate as well, and who knows, possibly even on Thursday in the vice presidential debate as well. Speaking of which, that's our third martini, the crazy martini, and in this event, we need to call out, at least to some extent, our brethren here on the right. There's a big hullabaloo this morning, started with the Daily Caller. It's the number one story on Drudge as we speak, and that's that in 1991, Barack Obama attended the wedding of his Harvard Law Review colleague Julius Genachowski to one Martha Raddatz. Martha Raddatz, of course, is now a correspondent for ABC News. She is the moderator for the vice presidential debate on Thursday. Conflict of interest is being screamed from the rooftops here because, of course, Julius Genachowski was ultimately named the chairman of the FCC in the Obama administration. So what they're failing to realize, of course, is that Raddatz and Genachowski are no longer married. But nonetheless, big hue and cry here, Jim. And I think it's largely a waste of oxygen, largely because Martha Raddatz is probably one of the more reputable folks out there.
Yeah, I think as a correspondent on the Pentagon and on national security issues for ABC News, she's solid. I have not heard a great deal of complaints from the right about her reporting. Generally, you don't get that these types of gigs if you're known as a, you know, crazy partisan. Thankfully, we haven't had, you know, Keith Olbermann or anyone moderating these debates.
Gosh.
Now, I'm glad we know this. This is probably worth mentioning and worth disclosing. I think it's not good for anybody on ABC News or anybody to kind of cover this up or anything. But look, this was 1991. The marriage has since dissolved. Obama himself is not debating at this one. This is the vice president and Paul Ryan. I guess it's good to have it out there, and that if Raddatz just, you know, does go crazy and ask really tough questions of Ryan and softball questions to Joe Biden, then yeah, then that will be a really legitimate issue. I realize there's a great deal of cynicism about mainstream media folks amongst some listeners, and in a lot of cases that cynicism is well-founded. But I think Raddatz understands the stakes. I understand her, you know, her reputation is going to be on the quality of the questions she asks and how she manages this debate. And I don't think she's going to, you know, go all-out attack on Ryan and go get all cuddly with Joe Biden. If she does, then yeah, this will be a huge issue. But my guess is she probably won't. It's rather cynical to bring this up one day before the debate. If folks on the right really had a huge issue with this, you'd think they might have mentioned this 2 months ago, 3 months ago, or when, you know, these moderators were named. So we'll see. I think she's going to be fairly professional in all this. Obviously, there's some folks in Washington who are very clubby. I don't think you can argue that someone should be disqualified if the president of the United States attended their wedding in 1991. it just seems like a very, very tough line to draw because, you know, Greg, who attended your wedding? You know, you never know when any of those people might end up being president of the United States. Certainly in 1991, nobody saw that in the cards for Barack Obama.
While you and I brace for the Rhino emails, I would like to point out the good news here is that the conflict of interest level is decreasing. Remember, 4 years ago, before the vice presidential debate, the big hullabaloo was Gwen Ifill's book about race and the rise of Obama. So, you know, that was a little bit different. And this one, not quite as directly involved with the campaign as that was.
Yeah. And by the way, it's entirely possible that issues like this work well for the Republican candidate because that makes the moderator realize that they have to be on guard for this perception. You know, that in a way, when the Ifill thing came down, I wondered if they had, you know, that the McCain campaign picked somebody with a alleged conflict of interest or an example they could, you know, call the person's objectivity into question, bring that up, make a hullabaloo about it right before the thing, kind of working the refs, so to speak.
Right.
You know, making the moderator feel like they got to bend over backwards to demonstrate that they're not biased in favor of the Democratic candidate. So that might be what's going on here, and it's kind of an interesting thing. Hopefully we'll get a really good debate. In the end, hopefully at the end of the night, you shouldn't be talking too much about the moderators. You should be talking about what the candidates said and how it went for both of them.
Yeah. Hopefully the Democrats are complaining about Martha Raddatz by the end of tomorrow night because that's all they were left with after the first one with their complaints.
She was as bad as Lehrer. Why didn't she protect the vice president?
Exactly. So hopefully Paul Ryan puts on a spectacular performance. We'll find out tomorrow, and that's when Jim and I will talk to you again. Jim, have a great day.
Looking forward to tomorrow, Greg. See ya.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today, and join us again on Thursday for the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.